Hey everybody, Morgan here. So I get a lot of questions about how to start a podcast, and it's honestly not that difficult of a process to go through. There's this website I use called Anchor, and it's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, distributing, and monetizing my podcast. All you have to do is go to anchor.fm/start. It's absolutely amazing. It's 100% free and so easy. All I do is upload my audio file, and Anchor automatically pushes it out across all of the different podcasting platforms. Go ahead and try it. I'm so excited to hear your podcast.
This is no simple reform. It really is a revolution.
Feminism, by definition, is the belief that men and women should have equal rights and opportunities.
In the church, there is full equality between men and women.
I hope that you know that your legacy will be measured in the service of every woman who follows in the trails that you've blazed, every woman who benefits from your daring and determination.
Hey everyone, welcome to She Speaks, a podcast about exploring the intersection of feminism and Mormonism, women's issues, and basically all that good stuff. We have with us here, as always, our wonderful producer, Jake.
Hello.
And we have an amazing guest today named Brianna Garrido.
Hi,
welcome.
Everyone. Hi, Morgan. Thanks for having me.
We are so, so, so excited to have you here. You know what? We normally have something called a news segment where we kind of talk about what's going on. I think I'm just so excited for your story. I think we might just barrel past that today. And I think
2 hours of church. Woo woo.
Oh yeah, there's that 2 hours of church. Kavanaugh got made a justice in the Supreme Court. All right. Let's get started. All right. Well, okay, so I met Brianna through a mutual friend. Mm-hmm. And I've been talking with her about her story, and it is just so amazing. And so today's podcast is kind of primarily about trauma and healing. It's about going through something or many, many things, a lifetime of things that are just so hard, things like sexual abuse, things like emotional abuse, and losing faith and then refinding it in a way that's amazing. And awesome. Well, I'm so excited about this. I'm really excited. I think that a lot of people will find a lot of meaning in this, and I'm actually really excited. And I'm always looking for. Well, I don't know if I'm always looking for, but right now I feel like I can take a lot from this. And so, so you're from Hawaii, right?
I am, born and raised. Awesome. Not like some people who say that they're from there and lived there for like 3 months, like born and raised from
Hawaii.
Nice.
Well, you're like legit Hawaiian.
No. So I am Hawaiian the way that people are Americans.
Okay, gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
So we're not.
Nice.
Not a native Hawaiian, but very blessed to have grown up, and my whole family's there still.
Awesome. Well, tell me a little bit. I guess just like a tiny bit about like your family and your home situation and just kind of how you grew up and how that impacted your view of yourself and your spirituality.
Okay. So I, oh boy. Where do I begin? I grew up in what is considered by any standard the ghetto.
Okay.
In Hawaii, yes, there are ghettos in Hawaii. It's not just all tourism. On a national scale of 0 to 100 of safety, 0 being the most unsafe and 100 being the most safe, our town rated at 13. Growing up, I was around a lot of drugs and alcohol, violence, domestic abuse, prostitution, gunshots, and sirens were normal. It didn't faze us. And I mean, like, my uncle at the age of 11 was beaten to death outside of our home.
Oh my gosh.
And so it's a pretty dramatic upbringing.
Yeah.
And it's funny saying it out loud, I think, because it was so normal.
Yeah.
The first time I realized that it wasn't normal to really grow up like that was actually when I came to Utah when I was like 18, and I saw all of these families around me. I stayed with my best friend, and I was shocked of no one yelled and everyone like spoke kindly to each other. So my family specifically didn't find the church until I was about 11, and even then I was kind of forced into me being baptized. It's what my parents wanted.
Yeah.
I was very Baptist at the time.
Interesting.
Very Baptist. I went to a private school on a scholarship. And that's even like a paradox in and of itself. Like, how do you grow up in the ghetto, but you go to a private school? But I was blessed with academic scholarships. I was a very driven individual. I think I had the privilege of seeing a lot of wealthy people and being really determined to not be my circumstance.
Yeah.
And my parents were always really supportive.
That's awesome.
And so I was surrounded by a lot of intellect, and I was surrounded by a lot of wealth, but wasn't exactly a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of those things was going to private schools growing up. And so I was raised in a very, very staunch Baptist private school where part of our history book actually said Mormons are going to hell.
That is history. Somehow
I brought that home to the missionaries, and that's when my parents made a rule that they're they're like, okay, you're not gonna talk anymore when the missionaries come over. I remember sitting in the pews as a child fantasizing about going up during fast and testimony meeting, wanting to tell everyone how Joseph Smith ruined my life.
oh my gosh.
Because I didn't like 3 hour church. My mom threw away all of my quote unquote immodest clothing. It was not a smooth transition. Girls camp was like a war zone in our home. Like, it was just that time of year where I was not going to go. But then I was converted by the Spirit.
What point was that? How old were you?
13.
13.
Yeah, I was 13. And one thing that I did recognize is how happy everyone seemed. And it wasn't like a constant happiness, but it was a noticeable difference than my life.
Yeah.
And I just craved it. So I didn't understand the Book of Mormon. I didn't understand the gospel at all. Knew nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like I wanted to be there.
Nice.
And I was a very, very active member from the ages of 13 to 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I became inactive because I was sexually assaulted by, a boy that I ended up dating,
after the assault.
Yeah. So I,
real quick for our listeners, we're just going to issue a little trigger warning here. If anyone has been assaulted or raped and has difficulty listening to stories about similar experiences, we just want to warn you that we're going to be talking about some of these subjects, so maybe don't listen to the podcast or take it in chunks, whatever's best for you. But we just want to let you know that this is something that we're going to be talking about on this episode. But go. Is this the first time that you were assaulted?
No, I was sexually abused as a child, but I think the sexual abuse as a child led to an inability to understand boundaries and what I was entitled to.
I think, you know, it's so interesting. Last week we had on a guest who she talked a lot about some of the neglect that she experienced as a child and how that kind of formed her views of the world.
100%.
And how she, like, in an effort to kind of stay in control of that world, she would take the blame.
Mm.
Do you feel like that's something that you also did where, like, you felt like, well, I deserve this. Like, this is something that belongs to me.
No, I didn't even realize it was sexual assault until probably 6 years later.
Really?
I thought that this was normal and this is how guys interact with girls.
Yeah.
Especially because my mom has 12 sisters and mm-hmm. sexual assault was talked about like casually and like commonplace in our home.
Wow.
I grew up thinking that it was normal for everyone to be sexually abused and molested. I grew up thinking it was normal for rape to happen. I thought that these are just like experiences that you, growing pains. That's just how the world works.
And so you really did kind of have that mindset of like, boys will be boys.
Oh, 100%. And it was difficult because In order for me to reconcile the sexual abuse as a child, I really viewed my value in what men thought of me, because that was the only way for me to make sense of the abuse. Of, they wanted to touch me and they wanted my body because they love me and they value me.
I was actually about to ask you about that. I feel like when my life experience has been totally different, but I feel like I grew up in a very female heavy matriarchal home where maybe it wasn't exactly the same, but kind of there was this like men hurt women.
Yeah.
Kind of vibe.
Definitely. Where, like, you don't want to come into contact with all of my aunties in one room.
Oh my goodness. But I feel like I kind of had this idea where, like, secretly, like, it was like, even though, like, on the outside I would be angry about it, there was something that was almost flattering about being assaulted.
Oh, totally.
And it's taken me a long time to kind of work through this.
And
feeling.
I still struggle with that right now. I have to I have come to
that doesn't mean that it's okay.
No,
to anyone listening.
The same thing. Doesn't mean dudes out there listening.
No, I've come to accept that the paradigm that is natural for me to operate off of is a lie.
Yeah.
I have to really rewire things and take a step back from a lot of situations and ask myself, what is truth and what is not?
That is so fascinating.
But yeah, so I was sexually assaulted as a 16-year-old, and I got a text message that night saying, "I'm so glad you're my girlfriend now." And I was like, "Oh, okay." Like,
did you know in that experience that you were being assaulted?
No, and then it continued to happen for weeks.
If you don't mind me asking, like, if you don't know that you're being assaulted, like, how does that work in a situation?
You don't realize that you have the right to say no.
Okay, so it's kind of like this, like, you don't want it to happen, but you don't feel like you can say anything.
Well, it's fight or flight. So I have a background in sexual trauma. I interned with Unique Foundation, great foundation for childhood sexual abuse, worked with the Rape Crisis Center, worked with UCASA, worked with Honey, and there's so many stats backing different things up, but especially when, so I don't know what the stats are, but there's a crazy amount of women and boys, but specifically girls, that will be sexually abused before the age of 18.
Yeah.
When that takes place, you don't develop proper boundaries because your brain hasn't fully developed until later. And so most of the people that are being sexually assaulted as young adults are in a lot of these situations because they do not understand that they have the right to say no. They do not understand that it's not normal to be in certain situations or circumstances, that it's not normal for someone to put you in certain situations or circumstances.
Yeah.
And so what in his head, because I do not believe he's a bad person.
Yeah.
At all. What in his head was probably sexual exploration and encouraging me to explore.
Yeah.
Was ended up being rape.
Yeah. I think you hit on something really, really interesting. I feel like there is this tension around consent. Like, what is consent? Is it something where, you know, like you ask and then the other person confirms? Is it where, well, they didn't say no? I feel like I've come out of dates before where, you know, there was, you know, something happened that I didn't want to happen, but it was almost like a disassociate, like I dissociated and I was just kind of in the back of my head being like, what is going on? Mm-hmm. But I couldn't like stop it from happening.
This is a very complicated thing.
Yeah. And then you walk away from it and you're like, well, I'm kind of bad because I allowed this to happen. But at the same time, like I didn't want it to happen, you know, like this happened to me but at the same time, like, is this assault? Like, you know, can I blame this person? Because I didn't say anything.
And this is why I love what Unique does. Because honestly, if we could eliminate childhood sexual abuse, most of these problems would be eliminated. I really believe that childhood sexual abuse is the reason for most drug addictions, most alcohol addictions, most of the emotional disorders that most people have. If you want to talk about it from a church standpoint, think about it. Like, sex is the most sacred thing, you know, within our doctrine, and Satan has been able to use it in the most horrific way, which is sexually abusing a child.
Yeah.
And so to talk about consent, it's so simple yet so complicated. And I know that from a secular standpoint, some may not agree with what I'm about to say, but
say it, lady.
The best definition that I've heard secularly is consent is an enthusiastic yes.
Mm-hmm.
However, that can come in many different ways, right? How do you mm-hmm. read it? Is it a physical enthusiastic yes? Is it a verbal enthusiastic yes? How do you gauge consent as you keep going? Because you can take it back and you can give it. And the best thing that I've been able to figure out is, you know, consent is given generally when the sexual experience that's taking place is taking place with the other person in mind. That the two people that are interacting with one another sexually are more concerned for the other person's well-being than they are themselves, than they are taking. And that's a difficult thing because there's such a prominent hookup culture here in America.
Yeah.
And so...
And that is about, like, the self.
And if you look at the Mormon church and our doctrine and standards, what is the safest space to make sure that sexual assault doesn't happen theoretically? In marriage. Because theoretically, husband and wife should love one another unconditionally. They should be communicating. The husband should be making sure that she is the priority and vice versa. Mm-hmm. One of the safest ways to preserve such a sacred thing. But how do you provide boundaries for people who don't abide by what we believe in? And that being said, I also am well aware that sexual assault and definitely abuse definitely takes place in marriages, especially within Mormon culture. Definitely aware of that. But that's the ideal, right?
Mm-hmm. This particular boy.
Mm-hmm.
So the role that he played in your life.
Yeah.
He played a very unique role, didn't he?
He effed me up for a long time. But I'm okay now.
Okay. How, if you don't mind,
mm-hmm.
you don't need to tell us like what physically happened, but how did what happened affect you
emotionally?
Oh,
I became hypersexual.
Okay.
I needed to own what happened to me,
mm-hmm.
and I became really promiscuous for like the following 2 years.
Wow, okay.
I needed to take my sexuality back because... I don't even remember if I verbally said no to certain things, but, like, I pushed hands away, and I looked horrified. I imagine, like, and I couldn't even look at him in the eyes afterwards. I avoided, like, I felt absolutely sick to my stomach, and yet he was my boyfriend, mm-hmm. and the only way for me to reconcile that is, I want this.
Mm-hmm.
I chose this.
Yeah. So, spiritually... Like, you know, you're an active Mormon at this point, or you're an mm-hmm. active member of the LDS Church,
mm-hmm.
the Church of Jesus Christ at this point.
No.
It's going to take some time.
There are bigger things for me to be worrying about right now. I'll do my best, but.
It don't feel like you have to do that. But spiritually, how did that affect you? How did you see yourself?
It's funny, before I came into this podcast, I was telling Morgan that this is going to be very complicated because there's such an array of abuse and there's so much like unpacking behind all of it. But at the same time, the details aren't really as important as the message that I want to convey. And spiritually...
Not necessarily, like, how spiritually were you, but, like...
No, I understand.
How
did it impact me?
Yeah, like...
I became... And honestly, this may have been something as a child that my parents instilled in me. We're, like, best friends now, but my parents and I were not on the same page for most of my life. I was a major perfectionist. I absolutely needed approval from everyone around me, and I was incredible at getting it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew how to shapeshift in a blink of an eye. I knew mm-hmm. exactly what to say and exactly who to be, depending on who I was in front of.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem, that was my drug. And the reason why there was an emptiness is because I believed that my worth, and this is something I still struggle with. I was in therapy today, and this was the topic of discussion. My worth is established in the value of what a man thinks of me. whether or not he believes I'm attractive, whether or not he believes I'm worthy, specifically at the time, whether or not I was a choice companion.
Mm-hmm.
I thought a man was going to save me. And I really have continued to believe that up until recently.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, I think, had to do with so many years spent trying to reconcile what happened by believing that they cared about me. And also, let's say that they don't care about me. Where is my worth then? How did this happen? Why didn't God care enough to stop it? If God can part the Red Sea, why didn't he strike this person with lightning before this happened? You know?
Yeah.
And so there were just a lot of questions that I had to wrestle with in regards to my self-worth. And it's something that I honestly have not really been able to work out until maybe the last year or so.
I think that that is something that a lot of people will be able to relate to. I think a lot of women will be able to relate to the idea that their self-worth hinges on how a man feels about them.
Mm.
And in relation to that, if they maybe know in the back of their head that this person isn't treating them lovingly and isn't really seeing them for who they are and really, you know, valuing them, then you have to construct a different narrative in order to survive.
Or there's a fear of, will anyone else? If I leave, who else will there be?
And so in a way, you kind of have to like lie to yourself to in order to survive and say, you know, like, well, this is as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, there's never going to be anything better.
Yeah.
And he loves me.
Yeah.
And this is love.
And because of that, I was repeatedly sexually assaulted every year after that. At least, I don't even remember, to be honest.
How did you get out of that? Or did you?
So I served a mission.
Okay.
LOL. Surprise.
I'm not surprised.
So I became inactive after that experience, largely because I repented for it and it did not make sense. And what didn't make sense is I didn't feel the peace that everyone said I should feel after I went through the repentance process.
Mm.
And I was pissed with God. Screw you, literally. Like, I did everything you asked, and I'm still not good enough. And I went off the rails. Ran away to Denmark.
All right. That sounds fun.
At the time of my life, only reason why I came back is because I was about to be deported, and I was due to attend BYU.
Okay.
Wow,
so this is all, like, as a teenager.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you crammed some stuff in.
I really did. And it made it more difficult because I graduated high school when I was like 15 or 16, so I was with like college kids most of the time.
Yeah.
As a child. I was really a child.
Yeah.
And even in Denmark, for example, like I you can find an article online that says Mormon girl is sexually assaulted at music festival.
Mm.
And it's written about me. And even when that was written, I felt so horrified with the title of that. I don't know if that was sexual assault. I feel so bad.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much guilt of blaming the other person that laid on my shoulders because I don't know. I don't know about if it's victim shaming, but honestly what ended up happening is I walked away from where my boyfriend was at and I ran into about 8 very handsome college men who were like dancing around a campfire and they had a rope and it was all fun and games. I was surprisingly sober
mm-hmm.
at this point. And I remember one of them grabbed me and put me up in the air and like started to like, there were like 3 of them actually holding me in the air and like walking around a campfire, like laughing and singing. And Danish people are so friendly. Like, I didn't mm-hmm. think a thing about it. And I also was a partier, and I thought it was hilarious until we started to walk away from the camp, and I didn't know where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
And before I knew it, I was in a tent with 8 men over me and on my back, and mm-hmm. I was pinned to the ground. And nothing technically happened outside of being groped over my clothing and
mm-hmm.
them forcing themselves on top of me. But even in this moment, I feel the the urge to justify their actions. If it wasn't that bad. And yeah. They didn't rape me, and there was no penetration. So was it really sexual assault? And was it? But at the end of the day, like, it's really not normal for a 24-year-old who doesn't know a 17-year-old to pin her on the ground and she's screaming, "Please no," and she has no idea what your intentions are, you know?
Yeah, I think. Oh my gosh, I'm just reminded of everything that's been on the internet like this past week about Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh and everything that President Trump has been saying about how, like, it's such a terrifying time to be a young man in this country, and how,
you know what, though, this is where I'm going to piss people off. I can empathize with that statement. I don't empathize with his intention behind it.
Yeah.
I can empathize with that statement, which is something we'll talk about later.
Yeah, well, I think that right now, kind of like what's coming to my mind is the way that everybody wants to make it so black and white.
Yeah, and it's
either she
not.
Was assaulted or she wasn't, or like there's evidence or there's not.
And this is what's crazy, and this is what we discussed earlier is, or this is what we want to discuss is, all of this is centered around justice.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the peace? Because that's all us survivors really want, right? It's all anyone wants is peace. Where is the justice? Where is the peace being found in the justice of all of this? When justice is given and when justice isn't.
Well, I think that, like, you know, with something as complicated, I mean, like, that I might be wrong in saying this, but I think that rape it can be somewhat black. It's a little bit more black and white. It's a little bit more obvious. But sexual assault is something that is so subjective. In a way.
But even violent rape is black and white. Look at what happened with what's his bucket from Stanford. Like, how the hell? How the actual hell did he spend only 3 months in jail?
Yeah.
Like, no, that should have been black and white. She was unconscious. You were raping her behind the dumpster.
Yeah. No, I think that kind of what I'm more referring to is the way that people come at it online, and they want to pick this apart, and and I think a lot of times people don't even realize that it's gray to the people that it happens to, and the only, like, there's fear there, and there's, you know, being uncomfortable, feeling violated, and knowing that, you know, this was not supposed to happen, this was not consensual, but at the same time, like, victims, in a way, can. I'm doing air quotes right now, but victim shame themselves. You know, victims can walk away with so many questions. And
largely because people are expecting us to understand what happened before we even get a chance to process it.
And I think that sometimes people just need to understand, like, the psychological ramifications of being sexually assaulted
is across the board.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's so confusing. Like, how can you expect someone to so confidently march up to you know, the police and be like, "I was sexually assaulted 20 minutes ago, and this is exactly what happened." Like, like, wouldn't that be great if it were that easy for everyone?
What people don't realize is that it's not like stealing. Stealing is like a physical thing that isn't very personal. Like, there's a very big aspect of emotional abuse involved in this, and manipulation and control. It totally, like, it rocks your whole world, and it makes you reevaluate everything around you. What's safe, what's not safe, what just happened? Even people asking, like, "She doesn't know the details of anything." Yeah, I get that. I don't remember 90% of the things that happened between the ages of 16 and 21. I don't remember people. I don't remember places because my brain was traumatized.
Yeah.
And it's such a hard thing to explain.
Yeah. But it, and I think that something that our listeners need to understand is that it still has a deep effect. Mm-hmm. It changes someone. So it is a crime.
Yeah.
It takes something away, and that thing could be peace. That thing could be understanding, like, it could be self-worth. It, in a way, like, you know, physical stealing is very black and white, but assault is a form of stealing.
Absolutely. Sorry, what I meant by that was more so it's easy to walk up to a police officer and say,
oh,
someone
yeah.
stole from me.
Oh, yeah. No, totally.
But with
totally,
this, totally. It's like, wait, what did they steal?
Yeah.
When did they steal it?
Did they steal
it? Is it my fault because I let them in the house?
Yeah. Did I give it?
I know them and they're good people, but I still feel like but they took it. So what does that say about them?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
When it comes to intimacy mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, I feel like the golden rule is broken. You can't just do unto others as you would have others do unto yeah. you. And I think that that's what guys and girls, I'll say, will think is like, oh, if I want this, then they must want this. And mm-hmm. that's how, like, they justify it in their minds. But I guess that's more just in situations where the girl isn't obviously resisting, you mm-hmm. know? If there's obvious resistance, then it ought to be very clear and obvious that
even then
isn't
I'll tell
right.
you how many times have I been in a situation where I resisted and someone thought I was being flirty.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah
I feel like I can't even say like how many times like I was resisting in my mind but I had no control over my body in those moments mm-hmm. and I was like,
or you're afraid as well of like
yeah.
if I resist are they going to rape me? If I resist, what does this do to my reputation? Am I making a bigger deal out of this
yeah.
than it is?
Like,
what happens
will they
if
embarrass
I walk out of
me?
The room?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. 100%.
It's such a confusing. Yeah, it's so confusing. Well, hopping.
To dial back in,
yeah.
though, you're asking how it affected my spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to go back there?
I guess I was more asking like your view of yourself, you know,
okay.
because you talked about like how important
so,
getting,
oh,
you know,
right. so,
signals
okay.
about yourself
got it.
Worth.
So I didn't realize any of this was sexual abuse or assault until not only after I came home from my mission,
mm-hmm.
but after I think it was 6 months after my mission, I went on an internship to Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what exactly happened, and this goes to show how my brain is still recovering, but I, by some miracle, ran into Taylor Rippey, who is a co-founder of Honey Organization, which is a resource for advocates, survivors,
mm-hmm.
educators, whoever. Mm-hmm. And this is before Honey exists. Oh, actually, I don't know. Oh, you know what might have happened is she was creating Honey and I ran into her and I asked her about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I heard the definition of sexual assault.
Mm.
And then I was invited into a seminar for all of the attendees at this conference. It was an international peace conference. And it was a seminar on trauma for war victims that were sexually abused and assaulted during war.
Mm-hmm.
And they started to go through this slideshow. And I remember it being the most horrific thing because
mm-hmm.
it felt like they were describing me. All of these symptoms, all of the aftermath of what can take place with a victim of abuse, what they struggle with, tendencies that they have, the way that they see the world. And I never until that moment identified myself as a victim of sexual abuse or assault.
Yeah.
Because I at one point even told my parents, I was like 17, and I said, I think someone sexually abused me. And they were like, well, you're fine now. Let's not talk about it.
Mm.
Like, okay. And it was in that moment where I realized that maybe this isn't normal. Maybe this isn't okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that started a very, very, that started a reckoning. And it started the journey of me taking my life back.
Yeah. How old were you when you kind of realized?
20.
So was this after your mission or
mm-hmm.
before? Yeah, right, okay, yeah. You said it was after your mission.
Yeah. And I came home immediately, met with my bishop. He was great, sent me to therapy. Mm-hmm. I walked into the office of the therapist. I still currently see the best man in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen him every single week for the past 4 years.
Wow. So how did that work with you going on a mission? You said that you felt like forgiveness or like that good feeling. Like it didn't really happen for you when you tried to repent.
I read His Grace is Sufficient by Brad Wilcox.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, because here was the problem. I was really traumatized. And the only way I knew how to cope with a lot of that was alcohol and drugs and sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, I'm not worthy because I keep falling into these things.
Mm.
This is all true about me. I need to continue to repent, but how do I keep coming back when I keep doing these things that are wrong?
Yeah, like the those are your crutches.
Yeah, and totally. And I read that talk, and the metaphor that really stuck with me, or analogy, was repentance is like learning how to play the piano.
Mm-hmm.
God knows you're going to make mistakes, and He just wants you to keep playing. So in my head, I began to normalize my coping.
Okay.
And I said, that doesn't make me a bad person because that's what the atonement was for, and I'm just going to keep trying.
I just want to hit on this because I think that you hit on something brilliant right there, and I just want to highlight this. This is actually something we were talking about at work the other day when we were talking about the cycle of pornography addiction. Mm-hmm. And how people will go back to pornography because of anxiety and how it's a coping mechanism for anxiety. But they have so much anxiety over not looking at porn that it's kind of like this, mm-hmm, almost like self-fulfilling prophecy. And so when you took away kind of this stigma of like, okay, like I'm going to make mistakes, it's okay. Like,
oh, totally. There's so much shame in addictions to porn.
But
like, that's what controls it.
But like for you in your life with, uh-huh, your coping mechanisms, like, mm-hmm, that is actually like, I feel like you enabled yourself to pull heal yourself out, mm-hmm, of that hole.
Whereas, and what's like interesting, Morgan, yeah, is now that I have like more intelligence behind this, this isn't for everyone. This is for me. I will warn that. I was never asked to repent again.
Mm.
By my bishops when falling into these things.
Wow.
When I had an intellectual understanding of what was going on, and when my therapist was involved, of, mm-hmm, this isn't me rebelling against God. This is me trying my best to like rewire my brain from something horrific that happened to me that was out of my control.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not the same really as someone that just wants to drink for the fun of it. Like, I drank to save myself, and I drank in moments where there was no light. And so from that moment on, not from that moment on, because I didn't have this knowledge until after my mission, but my post-mission on, my repentance processes have always looked very different with me and my ecclesiastical leaders and my therapist.
Interesting.
And that's not for other people to justify or go back to their bishops and use my experience as what they should do. But part of what really helped was, like you said, taking away that negative stigma of, this doesn't make me a bad person.
Well, I think that, like, in a way, that must have made it actually easier to stop, mm-hmm, using those crutches and 100%. Kind of stop going back to those behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Was when you kind of accepted that they might stick around for a little while.
Mm-hmm. And what's funny is that the second that I did, I went cold turkey on everything.
Wow.
Yep.
Listen up, people. Like, oh, that's so amazing.
Yeah, my in and out with abusive substances was never like a weaning off. It was either all the way in and falling down a black hole, or, mm-hmm, all the way out.
Yeah. Interesting.
But I decided to serve a mission because I thought that this was the way that I could prove to God that I loved Him and that I was a good person.
Wow.
Which probably wasn't the healthiest thing for me to do.
I feel like I hear about that a lot, though. I feel like a lot of people, like, it's like, this is my offering.
I was a psycho missionary. Psycho.
Explain that.
Like, I wanted Jesus to know how much I loved Him so badly that, like, I feel so bad for all of my companions. I mean, we taught... Oh boy, I'm just like we taught about like 38 to 45 lessons a week.
Where did you serve?
Sacramento.
Okay.
Which is not crazy. It's crazy, I think, generally. But the way that we baptized, I was just, there was no love in what I did. It was a system, and it was a system because I needed to prove I was the best.
Yeah.
And I needed to prove that I was the best so that I could prove to God that I was good enough.
And so in a way, I'm going to make a little psychoanalysis here. But
sure.
In a way, you were still, I hope no listeners will be offended by this. I'm not saying that God's approval isn't totally different than getting man's approval, but in a way your self-worth was hinged on how a man felt about you. Do you think?
I don't know if I would say that, because I really view God and man differently, but I did not understand God's love at all.
Okay. So in a way, did you kind of see it the same way though, as like, or like you went about using the same behaviors to earn his love?
Yes. I didn't view God and man synonymously, but the behavior that I went about seeking both of their attentions were exactly the same. Mm-hmm. The only difference is I never sought God out, like, sexually.
No. Yeah.
That was the biggest difference. But it was the perfectionism side of, I need to be the perfect human being.
Yeah.
I need to take 24 credits, and I need to get A's in all of them. And I'm, you know, like, I'm going to exceed in every single thing that I do to prove that I am enough.
Yeah.
And that my history doesn't define who I am.
I'm a little confused at the timeline.
Sure. Sorry. Okay.
Was it before the mission that you had this realization about your like addictions and you like?
That was the piano. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. This is hard.
And then you went on the mission.
Yep.
And then okay.
All yep. Right. Went on a mission. Went crazy. Ended up getting very sick and got sent home early.
Okay.
Because of what I was doing to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got home. Again, trying to figure out how to prove that I'm back in the game. Found this internship, got it miraculously. Went to Switzerland, and that is when I had this reckoning about sexual abuse and assault. And I realized how my whole life has been controlled by the abuse that took place, and that there was a lot of healing that needed to be done.
Yeah. So after that, So you do your internship in Switzerland, mm-hmm. and you come back. How soon after that did you meet?
Immediately, the next day.
You met your ex-husband, or...
Oh.
Or what are we talking about?
Sorry, the bishop.
Oh, the bishop.
Okay, so I thought you were talking about the bishop of therapy.
No.
Okay, my ex-husband. Yes, I am divorced recently.
Mm-hmm.
LOL. I met him actually... immediately afterwards, but we did not date until 3.5 years later.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Was he also LDS?
He was also a convert, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We met in a class.
Yeah.
We didn't get along because my grades were really important to me, and we were in a group project, and I don't play nice with other members in my group project. It's very controlling. Yeah, that's when we met, and between that time and until we actually started dating, I was full force on healing, became involved with every organization I could think of, again overcompensating.
Yeah.
I at this point still hadn't been able to work that out of me, but I was working with UCASA, and I was working with Honey, and I actually was kind of in the middle of that whole controversy that took place with BYU right before the amnesty clause was enacted.
Okay, I actually want to hear more about
this.
Yeah.
I hosted the first and last maybe rape awareness conference at BYU.
Wow.
I did not coordinate it. I was just asked to host it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was when we were holding the Q&A that Maddie Barney stood up.
Mm-hmm.
And asked her question directly to, I don't even remember who it was. the head of Title IX office, and that's when everything kind of blew up.
Can you give just like a tiny bit of background for listeners who might not know?
Sure. I'm trying to remember. I don't want to say anything that was false. But Maddie stood up and asked a question about, it wasn't necessarily a question, it was more a statement directed at, I don't remember her name, but whoever was head of the Title IX office. And it led to a lot of discussion and argument because Maddie's case was not handled properly. Maddie was victim shamed. And
was she expelled?
I don't remember, to be honest. Okay. I'm assuming not because she was there. Okay. Sorry, Maddie, if you're listening to this. I know her personally.
Oh, okay.
But
maybe I just heard like
from then on, the news media kind of took the reins, which was important because they provided light to the situation, but I also think that there was an agenda just to, you know, have news.
I'm kind of confused. Sure. So she asked a question.
No, and then she made a statement to... So during the Q&A, she made a statement about her case to the director of the Title IX office.
About an experience that she had had.
Yes, and that, like, it sparked a lot of argument and debate within the room. And
oh, right there in the conference, it sparked debate and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And so what ended up resulting from this is an amnesty clause, which entails victims being able to come forward and none of the details of their assault being handled directly to the Honor Code office.
Okay.
Because Maddie was forced directly to the Honor Code office. And
after she went to her bishop.
I don't remember.
Okay.
But...
Or BYU police.
I have no idea what happened. But basically, instead of asking her, are you okay? Mm-hmm. How can we help you? It was questions that are somewhere along the lines. I don't know if these were the exact questions, but like, were you in his room? Were there drugs and alcohol involved? And those are so not consequential. Like,
yeah, for if my memory serves me correctly, I remember reading that it was like a much older man who had lied about his age. And there was like some sort of date. And I don't know. Go research it for yourselves.
I do know that someone took a police report that was supposed to be confidential that I think Maddie filed and gave that to the Honor Code office. I hope that's not correct, because if not, I just am creating drama out of nothing. But I think that's what happened. Yeah.
Nobody get dramatic about this.
Yeah.
Go research it. Hopefully this will spark your interest.
But yeah, Maddie was a part of a big movement of change. It was very brave what she did.
Yeah.
BYU changed the amnesty. I mean, it created the amnesty clause. And interestingly enough, I had the unfortunate opportunity of seeing how effective that amnesty clause was a year later.
Let's hear about it.
So I was sexually assaulted at BYU a year later.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really difficult for me because there was a lot of shame surrounding it of how the hell did someone like me, who has a very now large understanding and knowledge of sexual assault and how it happens and the likelihoods and the statistics, how did I possibly get sexually assaulted?
And it had been a while since the last time, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like at least 2 years.
Okay. And it was this after your divorce?
No, this is before.
Okay. It was before you got married?
Right before I got married.
Okay.
And there's so much shame that surrounded it because in my head, I really believed I should have known better. Like, this must not have, because I know all the facts. I know the knowledge. I know how the brain works. How was I just sexually assaulted? Like, there's no way. And I dropped out of school.
Mm-hmm. Because of how it was handled?
No, I hadn't even told BYU at this point. I dropped out of school because in my head I was convincing myself that I'm pursuing other career paths, but in reality it was because I was horrified to go to campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I went home to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I started to date my husband in the process of this, and he was the biggest blessing.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest blessing. And I think that's how we got so close so quickly,
because
he was such a support in all of it. It also complicated things because I didn't know if I could trust him.
Yeah.
And I went home to Hawaii for a second. I came back with the intention of gathering my things, but ended up in a stake president's office. And he looked me in the eyes and he says, "Brianna, no healing can come until all things are brought out from the darkness into the light. And I am sincerely asking you to report this so that you can heal and so that other people also don't find themselves in the same situation." And BYU handled my case pretty impeccably.
All right.
Yeah. I was actually asked later on, there was like a report that came out on how safe people felt reporting their assault. And I was asked to be on another news station and talk about it. And I think they thought I was going to say something negative about BYU. And all I had is positive things to say. They really handled the case great. The only thing that was difficult for me is because a policy didn't have a way for me to come back into school without applying, even though the reason why I dropped out was because of the assault.
Okay.
Which made it difficult for me to apply, because as someone that recently experienced that trauma, your brain just isn't there. Like, you don't have the energy to apply. You don't want to. So I wish that was easier, but I also am able to see that it was a part of my path and my journey. Mm-hmm. And I now work for myself and I'm doing quite okay. So it ended up being okay. But that's when I met my husband. Mm-hmm. We got married shortly after that.
Okay. I feel like I'm always curious, like, when people have endured a lot of sexual abuse and sexual assault, like, to the, you know, where it's altered their worldview, and then they enter a marriage. And the marriage is, in a way, a clean slate, but they bring in all of these fault, or I'm just going to say...
baggage?
Like, yeah, baggage and maybe untrue ideas about intimacy.
I'm very blessed because I've never had a problem with intimacy in any of my relationships, and specifically my marriage. Mm-hmm. I did begin to learn that certain things that I, like, was accustomed to sexually were not normal. It was just things that were glorified in pornography.
Okay.
And so those are things that slowly made its exit.
Okay.
In healthier relationships. I didn't feel the need to please my partner sexually the way that I thought that I was supposed to and used to. It was a mutual relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Me and my husband specifically had no problem there. He was great and everything was generally fine. There were some moments where I think because of flashbacks, sex became difficult in the very recent parts of in the very beginning of our marriage, because the BYU Title IX case literally was like 6 months beforehand. And
yeah,
it was still being investigated while we were engaged and married.
Wow.
But that's about it. But I do know from what other people say, it's a very difficult thing.
So when did the church start becoming difficult again?
The church became difficult again when I personally felt like God lied to me.
Why did you feel like that?
Because I had two very contradicting pieces of personal revelation. Mm. And I guess what I more so mean by that is God asked me to do something, which led to something that was out of my control happening, and that event that was out of my control was completely opposite of something that was stated in my patriarchal blessing. So there was a major faith crisis, because the one thing that always gave me the strength to come back was my patriarchal blessing. So I had two options here. Did God lie to me? And patriarchal blessings are suggestions.
Yeah.
Or did I hear him incorrectly and everything around me doesn't make sense, including my marriage? Mm. And that was a very, very difficult thing for me.
Yeah.
And I didn't walk away from the church for a while. I was active for about a year into my marriage, maybe 8 months. And then I walked away. And... I walked away because I felt like there was no peace. I felt like God was not there. I felt like he had abandoned me. I felt like he kept asking me to do really hard shit and then let me to deal with it. I felt like I didn't know how to fix the situation. I felt like there was no community at church. I felt like I couldn't identify with anyone. I felt like a lot of things that were happening within the church didn't make any sense to me. And at the same time, I also recognize that there's no way I'm going to be a part of any other religion. Yeah. 0%. Nothing else feels right. And I cannot deny the truth and the light that I've already received, but how do I reconcile this with the confusion and the darkness?
Yeah.
And so I was inactive up until the moment my marriage ended. And I found Jesus real quick.
Wow. So was your ex-husband also inactive with you?
No. He was active the entire time.
And he was pretty understanding about...
He is a convert as well.
Mm-hmm.
And something that was important to me, and this goes, again, to show my faulty belief system and believing that a man is going to be my savior, something that was important to me was to know that his spirituality was even stronger than mine, mm-hmm. which was unfair. Like, he had joined the church a few years before we got married when I had 10 years behind my belt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And instead of me figuring out my own problems with God, I said, you know, you become strong and super, super, super strong, and I'll trust you, and then I'll come back.
Gosh, this is like, I feel like I can identify with that.
Which is so unfair. It was so unfair of me. And that's one thing that I do feel really bad about.
I think that a lot of women do that. I think it's really like the way that like it's kind of set up with like priesthood holders. It's like, well, they're the head of the household. Like, I go to them, and this isn't against you or anything like that, because I do mm-hmm. this, other women do this, but mm-hmm. I think in a way it's lazy spirituality.
100%. But it's not even just lazy spirituality. It's like sitting in victimhood and helplessness, believing that you're helpless. Mm-hmm. I really believed that there was nothing I could do, because prior to this, I was going to the temple like multiple times a week and fasting all the time and paying much more than our tithing. Like, I overcompensated again. God, mm-hmm. show me you are here. Got all the blessings in the world. Like, and the situation wasn't fixing itself.
Yeah.
And looking back, I realized there was nothing I could do to fix it except sit back, let the anxiety pass through, feel it, and watch God part the Red Sea and create miracles for me. And I never gave him the chance to do it because I was too busy working. And that's one of the biggest things that I've been talking to people about lately, is because there's so many tangible actions that we can do, faith without works is dead. Like, we're such a church of works
mm-hmm.
that we often don't give God the opportunity to work because
mm-hmm.
we're working. And I'm not talking about laziness. I'm talking about faith.
Mm-hmm.
We are not God. We are not capable of doing what his will is. And in moments where we feel helpless, it's because he is doing something. Do we have the faith to believe that?
That's really interesting.
Do we have the faith in ourselves to believe that we have the ability to endure until? I didn't.
I remember when I was younger, I used to have this mental image. I thought I was a genius for, like, thinking of this. But of, like... I have my world in my mm-hmm. hands, and I'm holding onto it so tightly, and I'm like, I will take care of this. Mm-hmm. I will do it. It will be fine because it's in my hands, and I'm not going to let it slip. And then God puts his hands underneath, and he's like, just drop it into my hands. Like, I'm going to catch it. It's going to be fine. And I'm like, no. Like,
wow,
I can't let this drop.
What a brilliant child you were.
I was pretty smart. But, it just kind of reminds me of that, of just, like, sometimes you have to let go of your world so that he can put his hands on it.
Oh, totally. And that's where I've come to, like, find my place of worship and peace.
So I kind of want to get into that just a little bit more, I think, especially, like, before we wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
You said that almost immediately after your divorce that all of this light and peace.
No, it wasn't even, like, the divorce.
Yeah.
It was the second I found out that anything was happening. I went straight to the temple.
Okay. So, like...
The moment I felt like the house was on fire, the moment I saw sparks, I went straight to the temple.
Like, literally your house was on fire?
No.
No. This is a metaphor.
My marriage, yeah. The moment that I felt like it was ending, I went straight to the temple.
And then that's when good things started happening spiritually.
Spiritually, yes.
That is so fascinating that it would.
And you know what happened?
Overlap. Yeah.
It was survival. I thought I was going to die. Literally, like emotionally, I was so weak. I did not know how I was going to wake up the next day. And so, you know, when we're in a position where we think we're going to die, that we grab onto the first thing that we think is safety. And it was a knee-jerk reaction, which was shocking for me when I later, like, sat back and thought about what I did. It was a knee-jerk reaction. I needed God. And not even because I understood anything, not because I understood what has been happening for the past year and a half, not because my faith crisis was all of a sudden resolved. It was a survival thing. I needed God.
So you go to the temple, you mm-hmm. start praying more, you start trusting him mm-hmm. more, and then you feel his love. Was it like, you know, in your immediate reaction, was there an immediate response?
My life continued to fall apart. I had no other option but to trust him. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even a matter of I felt his love immediately. Mm-hmm. I had no other option. The only other option felt like death. As dramatic as that sounds, it's just my world is falling apart. And
you needed something to
I
hold
need
on
to believe that you're going to fix this. And he didn't. Mm-hmm. I really.
And so you went to him to save your marriage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I pleaded and begged, and I, even at that point, was delusional. The way that I was still worshiping up until that point, it was maybe 3 weeks after all of this that I finally began to relinquish control. Even at that point, it's funny, I remember I was talking to a friend, and she goes, you know, Brianna, it was crazy when all of this happened, because you looked at me, and there wasn't even really fear in your eyes. You just kept saying over and over, what do I do, what do I do, what do I do? How do I fix this? Mm-hmm. How do I fix this? You were trying to fix everything again. And one thing that really helped is I read The Peace Giver, which is a fabulous book. Amazing book, which helped me understand the importance of relinquishing control over my life and learning to have companionship with Christ and God, which fills all needs. Mm-hmm. I don't need anything materialistically and even relationship-wise when I feel like those two things are solid. And that's why I am so active, surprisingly to most people, because you look at my social media handles, you interact with me on a daily basis, and I think that most people would be shocked to believe that I attend the temple as much as I do, or that I believe in the church and the gospel as much as I do. But this experience has helped me see that the only thing that matters is me and God. Mm-hmm. I'm not here at church anymore for community at all. I don't mm-hmm. seek community here. I seek to worship, and my only priority now is what do I need to do to draw closer to him? And that has forced me to stop listening to what other people think that I should do and what other people are doing for themselves to get close to God. Some people really believe that they need to not ever wear a bikini in order to remain close to God. Great for you, definitely not something I feel. Mm-hmm. And I believe so confidently in that. And that may change. And that's what's beautiful about the fact that we believe in continuing revelation, but that doesn't just apply to the prophets and apostles. It first and foremost applies to us. What is God telling us? Mm-hmm. And how do we stand so confidently in what he's told us so that we can have peace looking around us? There are a number of things that I don't understand or agree with in regards to church policy. But in my communication with God, I know this is where I'm supposed to be. And I know that he's in charge. And I know that there are learning lessons involved for everyone. And that we're not here to just immediately figure things out. We're here to have confusion so that we understand how to have empathy. So we understand how to have patience. So we understand how to empower ourselves as women and believe and stand up for what we believe in. You know, like, none of these things would take place if the church were perfect.
I think that's something that you said that's super, super fascinating, was that in a way this I guess like this desperate faith in God and totally disregarding other people and just focusing mm-hmm. on God and on Jesus Christ and on the power of the atonement, it allowed you to, in a way, just like completely pass over normal.
I have blinders on everything.
Patterns and, yep. and normal behaviors that mm-hmm. that were toxic to you and in a way prevented you from reaching
100%. And I think it's hard to just say like focusing on God, Christ, and the atonement, because what does that even mean? But specifically, I believe more clearly than ever that I can receive communication from God and that the revelation I receive is something I can trust. Mm-hmm. I can get his acceptance. He can tell me what I need. And he also loves me unconditionally. God's got my back. God loves me. I see that more clearly than ever. And I think that a lot of the offense that takes place in the church mm-hmm. largely has to do with, I know that we don't have too much time, but can I open something up in my phone that I wrote down for this?
Yeah.
Where is it? These are a couple of the notes that I wrote while I was preparing for this. It's a little wordy, but we only look negatively at the actions of those around us when we're unsure of our own actions, or the intention behind our own actions are not rooted in intentions that bring peace. So what I mean by that is when we're not confident in the way that we're living our life, we have a very easy tendency to look around at other people and judge what they're doing.
100% agree.
You know, so that was the first thing. Another thing is... Go on.
Just on that subject, I was actually talking with my sister Haley about this morning. It seems like everyone thinks that they are in the perfect spot. Like mm-hmm. if you're too spiritual, then it's like, oh, you're a Molly Mormon or you're a Peter Priesthood. Or if you're not spiritual enough, then it's like you're Jack Mormon or you're like on the fence about things or whatever. But everyone sees themselves as being in the perfect spot.
And you need to. It's because our self-worth is rooted in the wrong place. We need to believe that we are okay and we are standing in the right spot instead of, what do I need to do to get close to God?
It's so much in relation to other people.
Because like, one is dependent on those around you and one has nothing to do with those around you.
Yeah.
And it... there's like, so that you took it in the positive way,
yeah,
which is exactly right. But I think at the same time, there's also like the negative way of like, they see everyone else as having issues because they aren't in the same place that they are.
Totally. Which comes from insecurity of them not 100% being sure that they're in the right place. For example, when I've been most judgmental about modesty, it's because I'm being very modest and I'm not really happy about it. And I don't really know why I'm doing it.
I think that happens a lot.
And I'm doing it because everyone's telling me it should bring peace, but it's not bringing me peace. Because if it really brought me peace, I wouldn't care if you're running around
totally
being quote unquote immodest, because I'm happy. And I just want you to be happy. So whatever makes you happy.
And we think that we would be happier in our own obedience if other people would join us.
LOL. Yeah.
And it frustrates us that they look fine.
Yeah. Like, that's not fair because I'm so obedient and being modest when it's not easy.
I'm making the sacrifice.
So how are you happy when you're being quote unquote immodest?
And so we have to say negative things so that maybe they won't be happy.
Can I read a little more?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel that many of us go about our obedience in a way in which we are trying to buy love from God. Not only does that totally distort God's true character, but it puts us in a position where we're more likely to judge those who do not obey the way we believe we should, because then we believe we are less deserving of God. Okay, wait, that's actually... I think we've honestly covered most of the things on this now that I'm reading through it, but here's the one thing that I will say. I promise you... Every time we judge, it's because we are unsure of God's love for us and we're not standing in the security and peace that that love should bring. Every single time. That is one thing that I really strongly believe. And it's such an empowering thing because it gives you something to do. It has nothing to do with the actions of other people. You look back at yourself and you say, what do I need to do right now to feel God's love? Because when we are full of that love, no one else matters.
Yeah.
And that's really helped me as a survivor of sexual assault as well, because although I do believe that accountability is important and justice is important, especially to prevent perpetration to continue, that's not where peace is found.
Mm-hmm.
Peace is not generally found in justice. peace is found in knowing that you are loved and that you are okay and you are whole. And for us as Mormons, we believe that that's in God. And that's not something that anyone can control. Not bishops, not stake presidents, not apostles, not prophets. That is something that's strictly between you and your Father in heaven.
I love that. A question that, just to wrap up, mm-hmm. a question that I'm trying to ask all of our guests, and I sometimes forget, but I remembered this time. But I want to ask what, I mean, you know, this is a feminist podcast.
Yeah.
Newsflash. I'm just kidding. No, you know. You already know. But what does feminism mean to you? Because the reason why I'm asking this is because it means such different things to different people, and that's okay. Feminism is such a flexible term, and it can mean it's so unique, and everyone can live out their feminism or lack of feminism in whatever way feels appropriate to them. And so I just kind of want to ask people so that our listeners can kind of get a broader understanding of what feminism can mean to different people.
Sure. The immediate answer that comes to mind is believing that everything you need in order to be whole is already inside of you.
Ooh, I like that.
Both men and women. Mm-hmm. We are able to coexist among people the best, and we are able to operate from a place of empowerment.
I like that. So as a woman, you already have everything you need to be whole. Inside of you. You're not missing pieces that need Mm-mm. to be filled by a man.
There are things that can add to it, mm-hmm. but nothing can take away from your wholeness, and nothing is withheld from you, from your ability to become whole.
Wow. I love that, and I love the way that kind of weaves into your entire story, that kind of ties in your whole story. Jake, do you have any, like, questions or things that you want to say before we wrap up?
I don't think so. I mean, there is one thing that I want to say that has nothing to do with anything.
Go for it.
Is that okay?
Yeah, go for it.
While I've been sitting here, I got a text saying that my cousin just gave birth to 3 babies.
Whoa.
So, Mac, Radley, and Gavin, welcome to the world.
Welcome.
Yeah, that's been immortalized in history now. Very nice. Well, Brianna, thank you so much for coming and being willing to share your story and share your faith and just share the beautiful things that you've learned with us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for following. Thanks for helping me figure out the chronological order of everything and discuss things out loud.
Oh, it was beautiful, and we so appreciate that. And thank you to our listeners. And we're kind of starting something a little bit new, so bear with me. But it takes money to run a podcast.
Turns out
we didn't know this. No, I'm kidding. No, but it takes money to run a podcast, and so we've been kind of brainstorming different ways to help along this project that's really important to us. And one way that we're looking into is Venmo donations. So if you
That's a genius idea.
Well, there are other podcasts that do it too, so I can't really take credit for that. But yeah, I think that that's a really good idea. Yeah, so it's kind of like at your own discretion. So yeah, so we are going to actually start accepting Venmo donations for anyone who has really just loved the podcast, anybody who really just wants to keep it going. These funds aren't necessarily going to be lining our pockets. They're going to be going towards renting equipment, renting the studio that we record in. If you so desire to donate any sum of money, even a small sum of money, to
even just $500, like if that's all you have, like
we'll take it. But you can donate that at Morgan/Reber, and that slash is a hyphen. Morgan-Reber, and the image will be of the She Speaks cover art. That'll be the image. But thank you to everyone who listened, and we hope you'll tune in next week to another episode of She Speaks.